Hello, and welcome back to Affirmative Action. I'm your host, Antoinette Grajeda. February is Black History Month, a time when we shine a light on African Americans who have impacted our lives. Of course, there are plenty of Black Americans and Arkansans who continue to shape our world today, and that's one of the great things about history. It's this constantly evolving thing. Our understanding of the past changes as we conduct more research and question what we think we know. The present is history in the making, and anyone can contribute, be that by documenting the events of our present time or perhaps by being an active participant in creating societal change. History is all around us, and history happens every day. So how do we continue to study and learn about history, in this case Black history, outside of just one month each year? To dive more into this subject, on this episode, we'll hear from three Black women sharing African American history in Arkansas. Stephanie Sims is the museum director for the University Museum and Cultural Center at the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff. Christina Schutz is the executive director for the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center in Little Rock. And Charisse Jones Branch is the James and Wanda Lee Vaughn Endowed Professor of History and the Dean of the Graduate School at Arkansas State University. She says it's important to discuss Black history outside of just February.
Well, I do talk about it every day. Before I was a graduate school dean, I taught the African American History Survey and the Civil Rights courses. And I'm constantly talking about it or posting information on Facebook or some other social media. I'm constantly recommending books or telling people on Facebook, this is the book that I'm going to read next. So it's very much a part of what I do every day. And I think it's problematic, the idea that people are only talking about this once a year. That's not true. I think February is the month when all of these things should be highlighted, but it's certainly not the only time of the year that people are talking about it. So if you feel like you're only hearing about it one time out of the year, is that the response? Whose fault is that? Is basically what I'm asking. If you want to know more, do more, learn more so that you can be engaging this every day if you wish.
Yeah, absolutely, Charisse. I mean, we're Black 365 days a year and that doesn't change. And so I think we do a real disservice to sort of, I mean, use community at large, so like community as a whole, when we don't talk about Black history outside of just February. I mean, I would say the same thing about like, when we don't talk about women's history outside of March, we don't talk about, you know, disability history outside of April, when we segregate people to months, it's great to highlight. And, you know, we had one parent that the way she described it to her child, like trying to explain like why we have Black History Month and Women's History Month. She said, well, they need, you know, there's been a lot of history that hasn't been told. And so they need extra time to tell that history. Mm-hmm. And so I think that can be helpful, right? Of having that extra time. But I wholeheartedly agree with what Charisse has shared about, you know, we really should be talking about it throughout the year. And, you know, at Mosaic Templars, we do. We talk about it all the time. And we talk about it, not just in the sort of the field of history, but we talk about it in the film of, in, you know, the STEM fields, in the arts, because Black people didn't just make contributions in the past, but they make contributions every single day, that they're, Black people are vital to this country's, have been vital to this country's success, and continue to be vital and essential to this country's success. So
just to kind of piggyback off what they mentioned is that this is something that we are dedicated to. We know we have to learn our story, we experience it, and we want to share it. And also, when it comes to Black History Month, it's actually an opportunity for us to be creative and tell about other people that are not as renowned. Because everyone knows about Martin Luther King Jr., everyone knows about Malcolm X, everyone knows about Rosa Parks, but when you get off and you start talking about people like Silas Hunt or Samuel Kuntz, and especially with them being from Arkansas and with all of us being in Arkansas, and you bring forth our history, that's representation right there, especially when you're a native of the area. So this just, Black History Month gives us a chance to elaborate and be creative about our own experience and our own history.
Right, right. I mean, and even among the stories that we think we know well, I'm always telling people, you don't know Rosa Parks the way you think you do. You know the stories that you were told in school, a very a very sanitized, distilled version of who she actually was. And so that's your opportunity to take what you think you know and to push the envelope a little bit. There's a lot of scholarship out there about Rosa Parks that goes beyond that little old lady who didn't want to get up out of her seat on the bus, starting with the fact that she was 42, which is not old. Mm-hmm. You know, let's deal with that. And let's deal with the fact that she had a civil rights history that predated what happened in 1955. So I think there's an opportunity. I think the importance of doing this year round is to introduce you to not just people, but to events, to stories you haven't heard before, and to complicate those narratives. Who are these people really? You know, for example, people talk about Rosa Parks on the bus. They don't talk about the fact that she practiced yoga. Mm-hmm. And there are images of her practicing yoga, right?
And she was well up there in age doing that too.
Well, yeah, I had no idea.
Right. Uh-huh. I mean, she did yoga. She was an investigator for the NAACP, particularly she investigated cases of Black women who had been raped and sexually assaulted, right? So all of this was happening before 1955. And surely she wasn't the first person to challenge segregation on the bus. I mean, you know, again, the reason why it's important to do it year round is so that you understand that these stories are very robust, they're very nuanced, and they're very, very complicated in ways that most people have not been taught. So the narrative for a lot of people is, well, she was just an old woman who didn't feel like getting up. I promise you 42 is not old. I'm way older than that. You know, but that's the way people understand, have her encapsulated in this time and place as this sort of one-dimensional figure, and nothing could be further from the truth.
Absolutely. You know, I used to have an activity I do with like some of the graduate students on their first day where I'll say, okay, define like who a leader is, and let's look at people, and are these people leaders? Mm-hmm. And Rosa Parks is one of those people who on the surface they're like, oh no, like she just sat on a bus, and like, whoa. Mm-hmm. You're not hearing the whole story. You're not investigating. You're not looking further than just what's on the surface. I mean, even the idea of the buses and what the role of the buses were and how, you know, it ultimately ends, right, is because of a court case, not, you know, not just the collective action piece. So, like you said, it's that helping people understand this nuanced layer of history. The history is not just what, you know, the two sentences you read on the page of your textbook.
If you get that much, mm-hmm. right? If you get that much. And also, because we're talking about the Rosa Parks situation, what happens after that Supreme Court case? People don't just change their minds. You know, there are Black mm-hmm. folks trying to ride the bus and people are throwing urine at them and trying to harm them at the bus stop. So I think what's also important about that is to understand the how long these things continue to happen, even after people take a stand, even after court cases. It takes a while to change some of those habits, and a longer time, if ever, to change the way people think about certain kinds of people.
And history is this living thing, you know, things are happening right now that will end up in a history book one day. Mm-hmm. So with all that's happening right now, you know, what's the importance of studying history? What's the importance of looking backwards at things that have already happened?
Because we're all making history. Mm-hmm. Right in this moment. One day we're going to be very, very old people, and somebody may very well want to interview us about, you know, what happened in 2020, 2021. They might want to talk about the Black experience with COVID and with the COVID vaccine, and where did Black people really have a more difficult time accessing the vaccine than other groups of people. So everybody makes history. It's just that we tend to only remember the well-known people, and we remember them in an extremely limited way. So I think if someone didn't understand the importance of history before, they surely ought to understand it now, or they're missing something.
Well, and it impacts so much of, I mean, you brought up the COVID vaccine, right? When we think about health disparities, where there are pharmacies in communities, mm-hmm. Where there aren't pharmacies in communities, particularly in Black and brown communities, right? So when you're talking about distribution, so history impacts us every single day, whether we realize it or choose to acknowledge it or not.
And not even the distribution, the reasons why some Black people or some people of color would be extremely reluctant to get the vaccine, right? I mean, history matters. You don't have to have a doctorate in history to know something about the fact that Black people don't exactly trust the medical profession, and rightfully so.
So how do we decide what pieces of history should be shared and what should be remembered? We were talking about, you know, things that are happening right now. History is happening right now. How do we decide, or who gets to decide what's important enough to be remembered or to be shared?
Well, traditionally, the people who have had the power have made that decision. But hopefully going forward, we all have enough sense now to know that everybody's story matters. When I teach my history courses, I'm not just interested in teaching it from the top down. I'm interested in teaching it from the bottom up, right? I want students to focus on those whose stories have not been heard, the people who are nameless and faceless, because they've made history as well. I want them to also focus on very localized history. What does this look like in your backyard, in your community, within your family? You don't have to be famous in order for your history to matter. So I think that paradigm needs to shift significantly, where we complicate those who are at the top of the hierarchy and certainly complicate and unearth the histories of those who are at the bottom, right? Because when we think about how to access resources, and I've long said this, everything is not to be found in an archives. Not in a traditional archives, a repository. I've got a friend and colleague who talks about the significance of home archives or barn archives or garage archives. All of that stuff matters. And all of that stuff leads us to tell these very interesting and dynamic stories that you might not get if you just focus on a central figure.
But I think when you have that type of situation, like she mentioned, like Charisse mentioned, you have the power that may be who want to tell the story, who might want to kind of sanitize the overall experience. You have someone that comes and steps forward and says, no, that's not all that happened. So that's when the other side or other stories and experience and backgrounds come out. And that's when we come in and we try to reach out to people to do oral histories. Right. And that way we can document what's going on. And also, as far as to keep up with the methods and keeping it alive, we learn how to do all of those different transitions with the metadata and trying to keep everything that's, I'm saying all of these fancy words, born digital files. And we try to keep those alive through generations, because like we know about the flu pandemic from 100 years ago, and we're talking about it and we're making comparisons to it. And that's why I was saying earlier, it's the blueprint. Right. So we look at the past and we see what's happening and how is it mimicking it now? What can we do to prevent this? But a lot of times history repeats itself because we don't learn the first time.
People don't know to learn the first time.
No, they don't. But also you have some people that have the experience and they actually go back to a lot of things and look at it and they still don't want to learn from it. They feel that they may know enough for where the experience will be different. No. Okay, that's fine too. You look at that, you study that. What can we do to prevent this from happening again? Or how can we stop this? By no means. We should be where we are, but we're here. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we have to still document what's going on, because there are going to be some things omitted 100 years from now. Mm-hmm. But with us and what we do, we stay on top of that, because we know in the past they have omitted our stories.
Right.
And a lot of our stories have gone in the grave with the people that passed and had those stories. Mm-hmm. So we try to get on top of that now. Right. And we become the host of that. So that way it's accessible in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's a saying, and I'm going to say this badly, but you'll get the gist of it. When an ancestor passes, a library dies.
Yes.
Right. And so when they're gone, you know, what do we have? And so that's why things like what we have here at Arkansas State, and you all may have this as well, we have the History Makers database, which is the largest database of African-American oral histories in the country. And most of those people are not famous, but they are people who did some really wonderful and extremely important things, histories that might be lost otherwise. I know one of the things that I'm a part of is a committee, I think it's with the Arkansas State Archives, but they won this ginormous grant to record, to digitize all of these newspapers. And some of them are Arkansas African-American newspapers, right? Some people think if they know this, that the only one was Daisy Bates, Arkansas State Press. That was not the only newspaper, right? There were others. They may have been short-lived, but they were there. So what stories do they tell us about Black communities in this state that we're not going to hear about from the Arkansas Gazette or mainstream newspapers? So preserving those kinds of things are critical in my mind, because it allows us to flesh out and unearth those stories that let us know that these were vibrant Black communities, Black spaces, Black institutions. Never mind what you're looking at now, there's a history there that for some reason has disappeared. And I'm the historian who wants to know why. I want to know what that history was. I want to know what happened. And yes, there are some nuggets in there for the future. How do we stop this from happening? Or how do we revitalize those spaces that have lost that history or that vibrance, whatever you want to call it? So that's why what we do is absolutely critical. I mean, I have made my professional career on telling stories about people nobody thinks about, you know? And I have to tell you, that's worked out for me extraordinarily well, because people are like, well, they didn't do X, Y, and Z. Well, I just wrote a whole 217-page book about exactly that.
I love that paper you had done about the women. I think it was the one you presented here about the women in the prisons and talking about, like, unearthing like female prisoners. Yeah, because again, it's one of these kind of populations where we don't think about that history, and we don't think about those stories being told. You know, it's often said that, like, we only know about Black women because of the violence perpetrated against their bodies. And right. So being able to unearth and share different stories, I thought it was really
cool. And hear their stories of resistance, right? Because here's the other issue for me. When people talk about African-American history, they're talking about men. When they talk about women's history, they're talking about white women, right? Neither one of those perspectives represents me or women like me, which is why this work is so absolutely crucial. And as I said in another recording I did, it's not just about Black victimization. Mm-hmm. It's about Black empowerment. It's about Black institution building. It's about Black entrepreneurship. Those are very rich and robust histories right here in Arkansas. You don't have to leave this state to find any of those stories.
Arkansas definitely has a rich history, a rich African-American history. As we're recording this, just today, the Arkansas legislature was debating a bill that was wanting to ban the use of the 1619 Project in public schools. It failed in committee, but over the course of 2.5 hours, there was a lot of discussion about who gets to teach what in schools. And it was really interesting. The arguments were, we should have different perspectives. It shouldn't just be one or the other. But there was also a debate about who gets to decide what that curriculum looks like. And one suggestion was even that parents should be allowed to opt in to have their students learn or not learn something. So when it comes to, you as historians, what would your advice be, or what would your maybe preference be as to how these types of things are taught in school? Because for a lot of students, particularly if they're not a minority, that's how they learn some minority history.
So it's all Arkansas history. And it should all be taught in schools.
It should all be taught. And one of the arguments I heard was that, well, we don't want to make people feel bad. And this sort of patriotic flag waving, uncritical history, I think does more harm than good, right? I mean, we are a nation where the demographics are shifting, and we're hearing stories that we have never heard before. And I quite frankly think it's wrong to deny any student access to that kind of information. You want to be a good American, deal with the complexity of that, which is to say that there were the high points, there were the extremely low points, but we are still striving and moving forward as a nation. But you can't just focus on the, we're trying to be better as a nation without really examining what the reasons why we're trying to be better, right? And nobody's implicating anybody for anything, but this is what happened. And we need to be fair and honest about that. Otherwise, we'll have what we've always had, which is people making decisions about whose history is relevant and whose isn't.
Well, it's a fear-based thing, right?
And
it's ultimately, right? I'm afraid that you're not going to talk about me or my history, the history I want told, in a positive light, and that it's going to change this ironclad notion that I have about history. And like any historian will tell you, history is an ironclad, right? That we're always reinterpreting, rethinking, relooking at things. Right. And
or
that
we ought to be.
We should be, right? And our historical figures are not fragile. Like, they were people. They didn't always make the best decisions, right? They made some really terrible decisions that disenfranchised a lot of people. But that doesn't change, like, what happened. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as we've already talked about, right, that importance and the piece about learning it helps us to make better choices in the future. It helps us to understand, like, oh, we don't have to make that terrible choice again.
Right. Because this is what happened. And I'll tell you, I mean, as a professor, I have routinely had the experience of having white students who are angry, not at me, but angry because they didn't learn this, because they feel that they have been cheated, that they have been denied this history. So what that suggests to me is that they aren't but so fragile, right? They want to know this. And I suspect what they also want is the authority to decide how they're going to deal with it rather than having someone else tell them that. They want to know.
Absolutely. You know, kids, I mean, we've been working on this children's gallery and building this here. And so what's really fun about it, just all the literature and the research that talks about, like, kids understand race as early as 6 months,
right?
And they prefer the race of their caregiver, like whatever skin color their caregiver is, over another race, at very early ages. And so the idea that kids already see differences in the world, they're already thinking about and talking about these things, and giving them the language to do so, right, empowering them to move forward, would ultimately be better for everyone, right? Rather than sort of tiptoeing that we often do when it comes to history, you know, trying to think about history as this unbiased thing that it's not, right? But we think about it, again, in these sorts of ironclad ways that it makes it unmovable. Right, it makes it difficult to talk about and to question the narrative that, you know, that we've been given, because we think that somehow if we question the narrative, it undermines that person, right? When maybe it doesn't, maybe it makes them more complex. Maybe it helps us to understand that, you know, they had difficult decisions to make too.
Right. And, you know, and when I think about children, and I don't have children, but I remember being a kid. And if I fell down and scraped my elbow or my knee or whatever, you know what I did? I cried for 2 minutes and I got up and I kept going. That is to say that children are resilient. So it really begs the question, who's really afraid here, right? Because children are much smarter and much stronger than people give them credit for.
What were your experiences as children then learning about Black history? Was it something you were exposed to at school, or was it something you mostly got from family or seeking it out on your own?
For me, it wasn't something I heard a lot about at school. And I went to segregated schools until the ninth grade. So this would have been 1980. But we had the Ebony Encyclopedia of Black History in my house. And I read all the time. And I know one of the earliest history books my father gave me was, I think it was Before the Mayflower. And my dad is a retired electrical engineer, so not a historian by any stretch of the imagination. But these were the kinds of books that were in my house. And so I wasn't learning it at school. I was learning it on my own. And when I would read the encyclopedia, the Ebony Encyclopedia of Black History, and we also had the Encyclopedia Britannica, and I figured out very early on that some stuff was missing. And so, you know, I really didn't know how to articulate that as a kid or whatever, but I just remember being in middle school and being in high school, taking these social studies classes, and I didn't see myself reflected in it.
So for me, I went to actually predominantly white schools my entire education. So I actually didn't have a Black professor until I was in graduate school, which tells you what kind of history that often gets talked about in the school. I didn't learn about Black history until I started doing my own research when I was in undergraduate. And I had a professor at the time who I was kind of working for, and he said, "Hey, I've got this box full of topics, and can you take this topic and go research and find some stuff about it?" And it was actually about Black soldiers in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And so that was my first foray into Black history, but it was all, again, outside of the curriculum. Right. It was all outside of the sort of traditional classroom spaces in which I learned and explored that. And I think it's really interesting. So my mom was very much a, not only are you going to learn Black history, but really I want you to learn all, like, other people's histories as well. So she was really big on taking me to museums that didn't even represent my own culture, right? Because she wanted me to have sort of these cultural experiences that were outside of, out of myself and what we had in our family. But I think it does a real disservice. It's sort of interesting to me that I teach and talk about Black history all the time now. Again, not having had that background at all, and having to be really forced to sort of explore it on my own.
Yeah, I also wanted to, that was my experience as well. I had a Black teacher like I said, I went to segregated schools up until the 1980s, but I had my first Black professor in my first African-American history class in college, because they just weren't teaching that in my schools. And also the other thing is that for so long, like, my mother's generation had been taught that history wasn't important, mm-hmm. right? I mean, I come from Charleston, South Carolina. I'm Gullah on both sides of my family. And my mother's generation, and my mother grew up on the Sea Island, they were told that you were uneducated, ignorant, whatever, if you spoke Gullah. So pretty much that Gullah-speaking community, at least among my mom, stopped with my grandmother. And of course, they didn't dare teach us that because they wanted us to be, you know, solidly middle class. So I think that's a lot of it as well, is so many Black people believing that the little bit of history they did know about themselves was just unimportant.
And my experience was a little different. Maybe, and by no means do I mean this in a negative tone or a negative way. I am a little younger. And so I actually was exposed to, I'm sorry, I didn't
mean that to me.
Hey, I mean, don't look at me.
I know me, but.
I deny that I have a gray hair if you ever say that.
But I was actually exposed to that in elementary school. And I'm just gonna go ahead and put my age out there. I'm 34. So I remember seeing a lot of the teachers that looked like me that put those programs together to make sure that everyone was exposed to that and learn about that. And I remember maybe about the fifth grade, I participated in something our entire class did. And my teacher was a Black woman. Mm-hmm. And I'll never forget that woman because she exposed us to so much. And she was just, she made us proud of who we are. And because she knew that we were going to be Black 365. Right. And one of the main things that she actually did, she had this, she received a gift and it was a calendar. And each day on the calendar, it had a quote by an African-American person or maybe an organization. And so what she did was she assigned that quote to each one of us. And a night of the performance, we all dressed in Black and she called us our Black pearls. And we got up there and we snapped our fingers and we said our quotes. And I never forget that stuck with me. But it was because of those teachers knew that no, representation matters, and we need this program, and we need everyone in the school to understand why this is so important to us, and I appreciate them for doing that. So I was fortunate enough to have an African-American teacher in the fifth grade, but I was also surrounded by them, even there with third grade teachers and all of that, and they still look after me as if I was one of their own. So my experience was I don't trade it for anything.
And so I think that's absolutely wonderful, because even though I went to segregated schools, most of the teachers were white. Mm-hmm. So I remember having between, what is it, maybe the first grade through the ninth grade, I only remember having two Black teachers, and they didn't talk about that kind of stuff, right? Because I think part of what was happening at that point was, you know, you wanted to be accepted. You wanted to be deemed acceptable. And so you didn't emphasize that kind of history. And I tell people very candidly that my parents were not supportive of me becoming a historian. They didn't get it. They didn't understand why I would want to do this, and I wasn't going to make any money teaching that kind of history. Now, they're my biggest fans now. And anytime I do anything, I know I have to send something down to South Carolina. But I tell people that wasn't always the case. And what they tell me is that we didn't know. We were told we didn't see ourselves portrayed positively in the little bit of history that we did learn. We didn't know that there was this whole other world and this robust field that people dedicated their careers to studying. So yes, they're my biggest supporters now, but 25 years ago, that was not the case.
Now, it can definitely be a narrow road, because my background is also in visual art. And so when I said I wanted to be a graphic designer, everybody turned their nose up at me. And so now they are one of the first ones to reach out and ask me to do research for them, to design a logo, all kind of things, different things. That then right.
Like, oh, hey, did you read this?
Yeah.
Okay. About 25 years ago.
You know, but I think that's probably what ignited the fire in us, because we had so many people that looked down on it. And we like, no, this is actually a big deal. You know, this is my passion. And when you have a passion for that, it definitely shows. And not only that, it influences the naysayers. Like you mentioned, they become your biggest fans, and we didn't ask for it, but hey, I'm glad you joined.
Well, I think they begin to see it's like an actual field,
career. Because they weren't exposed to it, they have no idea on how far you can actually go with it. Because a lot of them just think that the furthest you can go with history is just being a teacher.
Right.
They don't think outside of that or what
and
level.
They're still thinking that way. I mean, you're supposed to participate in new student orientation, and students would routinely tell me, well, I'm interested in history. I love history, but I don't want to teach. Well, you don't have to. You can go to medical school.
But a lot of them think that's the only way that they can get a consistent paycheck. And, you know, just as simple as that. They and as far as to finance their lifestyle and just to kind of make a living for themselves, they think they have to teach because that's the only thing that's consistent in the field. And
right,
it's not.
Right. Absolutely. Or I even had somebody tell me, was there any history left to tell?
There are over 15,000 books about Abraham Lincoln. And they still come out with books. There are over 15,000 books about Abraham Lincoln, and they come out with more books like every year. So
it's not oversaturated,
right? So I mean, if we can still come out with books about, you know, a president that was, you know, number 16, and we're what, 46, 47 now, you know, if we can still come out with books about people back then, yeah, there's still plenty of history.
And bookstores have entire sections dedicated to the Civil War.
That's so true. Yeah.
There's still some stuff to tell.
Absolutely. But I think like y'all said, right, it's this issue of representation within the field, within the sort of history, you know, I'd put library, archives, museum field, where you don't necessarily see people, you know, high up in those positions. I mean, I can count on my hand, like the number of of Black female directors, museum directors, right, in the South.
Right.
I mean, it's not a huge number. And so, you know, when people are looking at it, they think, oh, I didn't even know you could do a career in that, right? I didn't even right. know that was actually a thing people did.
Or even like, I mean, I have written mostly women's history, and in particular, Black women's history. And people are like, I didn't know you could do that. I'm a life member of an entire organization, the Association of Black Women Historians, where that's what we write, Black women's history. And some of these people are extremely well known for their scholarship. Just because you haven't heard about it doesn't mean it doesn't exist and that it isn't viable.
You've all done a lot of research in your fields, and so you obviously have more knowledge than the average person, but through your research, who is an interesting figure to you that you didn't know about? You know, we talked earlier about how everybody knows Martin Luther King, or they all know some version of Rosa Parks. For you in your research, who's someone that you learned about that you didn't know about that was, you know, really impressive to you for whatever reason?
I'll just mention, because I've given a presentation on this person and they're in my forthcoming book, but this woman named Annie Zachary Pike. So when I was doing my research on rural Black women, I kept seeing her name and I didn't know she was still alive. And she's alive and she's doing quite well. And I had to have some intermediaries help me get in contact with her. And then I eventually got to go down to her house in Marble and interview her. This woman is a substantial landowner. She and her husband were substantial landowners. They had sharecroppers working for them, right? They, in the late 60s, early 1970s, took, I don't know, maybe 40 or 50 acres of their land and created a subdivision for the sharecroppers who had formerly worked on their land. It's called Zachary Subdivision. It's in disrepair, but it still exists, right? This same Black woman was a prominent member of the Arkansas Republican Party. She went to the Republican Party National Convention in 1972 with Governor Rockefeller, right? She went to the National Federation of Republican Women and gave a speech at that conference. And then she came back to Arkansas and ran for the Arkansas State Senate. Still alive, still in Marble, Arkansas. And the only things I was able to find about her in the archives, I found a flyer from her campaign in the archives. I think she was on a list in the Arkansas Republican Party papers, but everything else I got about her either came from looking at newspapers, mining all sorts, all manner of documents, and the stuff she kept in the Tupperware bins at her house, which I went down there with my iPad and my TurboScan app and scanned all of that stuff, right? So I have a picture of her badge from the Republican National Convention, where she was a delegate and was the co-chair of a subcommittee. And there are letters in there from Rockefeller and Bill Clinton and people. None of this is in the archives. These people exist right here in Arkansas. So that's the stuff that intrigues me. And I don't mean to monopolize, I'm sorry if I am. But you know, when I started writing my book on rural Black women, I started off by doing just a little paper on Black home demonstration agents, just because, and it just spiraled into this whole other thing because someone told me, oh, there's no story there. I was like,
don't we love a challenge?
We do. Because my first thought was, I'm gonna tell you like my mama used to tell me, I can show you better than I can tell you. Mm. And it turned into this thing that allowed me to give a paper in Spain, in Paris. The British Agricultural History Society invited me to come to England to talk about these Black women. I said, you know, I talk about Arkansas, right? Do y'all even know where that is? And they did. So I took a graduate student. That's why this is important too. Take your graduate students. And I took a graduate student from little teeny tiny Palestine, Arkansas, 681 people. And I think they're exaggerating. but I said, get a passport. We're going to England. And I took her and I gave a talk, you know, I gave a talk on these Black women in Arkansas. They were fascinated. They were just completely dumbfounded. And then I said, look, I just flew 5,000 miles. One of y'all gonna ask me a question.
Oh, I wish I could have had you as a professor when I was in college. Right? I'm just saying, it would have been cool.
Yeah, I was like, no, you're going to go to England. And by the way, that student is in her third year at Cornell.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's why what we do is important. It's important because, I mean, we have enough intestinal fortitude to do the research to demonstrate what Black people and Black women in particular have done, and to also bring other people along into the profession. Mm-hmm. You know, because this little girl, she was like, I don't want to go to New York. Oh, you are going to New York. Pack your stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know anybody. Well, that's how you meet people. You got to get there and start getting to know folks. Absolutely. And she's doing fine. And she's doing just fine. But yeah, it started off as a challenge. They told me that there wasn't anything. They told me that these rural Black women who pick cotton all day weren't involved in any sort of political activism. I said, that's not true. That's not true. It wasn't true.
It's fun when you get to find those untold stories. I was thinking about Stephanie and I did an exhibit together on hair, on Black hair. And you wouldn't think, people are like, oh, you're doing an exhibit on hair?
Yeah, why not?
Right? It was amazing, right? It won the Arkansas Museum Outstanding Exhibition Award for the year. And what was fun, it was so awesome because we got to talk about not just the hair, but the culture of hair. We got to talk about business and how these women were elevating themselves out of poverty,
right?
And using this agency of doing their hair and doing their community's hair and making hair products, right, as a way to build and uplift their community. So it was super fun, and it was something that was so different. I mean, like I said, using something as simple as a curling iron, right, or a pressing comb as a jumping off point to talk about the technology and the history of this unique industry.
Yeah, no, I am a huge fan of the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center. As a matter of fact, I just signed up for a thing the other day, so y'all will be getting $20 a month.
Thank you. So sweet.
Because those spaces are important, and even where the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center is located is significant. Yes. You know, I've taught students from Little Rock. They had no idea about that section of Little Rock. I mean, they can tell me something about, you know, Black Wall Street in Oklahoma. I said, you don't have to cross the state line for that. Drive 2 hours south down to Little Rock. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about that. Well, you do now, you know? That's why this is important. And I also think it's important because it's necessary to shift minds about how people think about Black people, and that is to include Black people, right? Many of whom are like, well, we didn't do anything, or we didn't accomplish anything. How much time have you got? Let me answer that for you. You don't have enough time for me to sit down and help you understand all the things that Black people have done.
Yeah, I have to say, it's the best part about going to like the Black Museum Conference. So there's an Association of African American Museums, because you get to hear about what Black people did all over the country.
Right.
Because, you know, you think about it, you're like, oh yeah, like in my area, in my state, in my region. But when you hear the sheer variety of museums that exist and how they came to be, like the activism that led them, where it was that, you know, the community's mother, this, you know, person, this woman who was storing stuff in her Tupperware bin and said, oh, I'm going to open up a little museum in my house, or I'm going to, okay, now let's move down the street, right? All that funeral programs all over town, right? It's those kind of folks that build institutions like this.
Yeah, and especially with those obituaries, because in our repository, we have boxes and boxes of them, and we actually build a biography files off of that. Mm-hmm. And so what a lot of people are not aware of is that obituaries are legal documents. And so when you have someone who writes the obituary and they said that this person only had one son, and you heard that he may have had a daughter across town, if the daughter is not included, she's just not a part of the overall deal, you know, of the settlement. So with having all of that, and also just when you have those type of stories and you have those type of people with the Tupperware archives, you try to kind of encourage them to say, hey, let's bring this stuff over here and we can actually make an exhibit off of this. Or we can, even if it's small or big, it can actually grow and tell a major part of a story. But one of my most fond memories or things that I had to research is most recently, because now it'll be 100 years since Black Wall Street was eliminated. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of talk about O.W. Gurley. And so he is a native of Pine Bluff. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that you have all of these different blogs and narratives and people doing research and they're saying one thing and another blog is saying another. So if one blogging saying, oh, he was a graduate of Branch Normal, and another one said he attended, it's up to me to find out if he attended or if he graduated or both.
Right.
So with us collecting primary sources, I know the answer, but but you know, with us having our primary sources, we have to make sure that the story is told and told correctly. Because the last thing we want is someone who does not look like us to come back and discredit our research, because it tends to happen.
Right.
So, and
we tell a totally different story.
Like absolutely. And so, And so, another thing that was brought to attention a couple years back, there was an article written by, I can't remember the professor's name right now. He's a professor at Euler. He usually does all of the civil rights stories.
Oh, John Kirk?
John Kirk. John Kirk wrote an article about how Dick Gregory was arrested in Pine Bluff in the restaurant that he was arrested in, and which is not even a mile away from the campus. It's on University Drive, and it's right across from the Golden Lion Stadium. And so when you do your research and you tell these stories and you say, no, the infamous comedian was arrested right there, it puts especially students who are not aware of who he is, or they get to know who he is and they actually see a landmark and associate with that, that kind of brings them to where they want to dig more and learn more about it. So not only do you tell the story, if you give them some kind of visual, that kind of brings it to life. And so that was one of the, which when we found out about the article and we actually realized that the location was right down the road, that became a part of an exhibit that we put together last spring for Black History Month, which was entitled Rooted in Change. And so it talked about the civil rights movement with the national sit-ins and how it was brought to Pine Bluff. And then we had notable figures that were a part of SNCC, and like the late John Lewis came and actually attended some of those meetings and ceremonies or whatnot and events right in Pine Bluff.
Right.
And so it takes you to do the research, find all of these different archives and other people who talk about it. And there was a woman that came to the opening and she was one of those participants who did the sit-ins and the demonstration, and she was 13 years old.
Right.
While everyone else was so much older than her. Right. And so to hear her story, you know, it brings a lot of things to life. So that's actually one of two of my favorite research and that I actually came across them recently.
So in case you haven't figured it out, Antoinette, we really like what we do.
No, and I love that. It's so obvious, but it's good because you need passionate people to keep these stories alive. I think that's so vital to keeping history alive and keeping this at the forefront of people's minds. So I guess as we wind this down, what are some things that you think could be done maybe better in the future to help people like you continue to keep Black history at the forefront of people's minds more than just in February?
I think more of what we're already doing. So like, for example, here in Jonesboro, we've got KLEK 102.5 FM, and it's the first African-American owned and operated radio station here. And four times a day, I do Black history moments. I mean, not literally four times, I record it, but that's a huge service to people who've never heard this history. And I'm not just talking about Black folks. I'm talking about a whole lot of non-Black people who are like, I didn't know, I hadn't heard, you know? So I think more of that is important. More of that sort of public facing work is absolutely necessary. You know, we've got social media, amp that up, right? I mean, I'm always, because there's always a historian or a scholar or somebody who is publishing an article about whatever. So like the other day, for example, I published an article about a woman who sued for her freedom in Illinois and I think Abraham Lincoln, before he ever became famous, right, was one of the attorneys who helped her gain her freedom. Now, to me, that story is not about Abraham Lincoln. It's about that woman being tenacious enough to say, I'm living in this free state, I deserve to be free, and who's going to help me accomplish this? I hadn't heard that story before, right? So every day there are stories like that. And so I think, you know, we are, and we need to continue being good stewards of the history we know about and the history we don't know about, right? If I always tell my students, each one teach one. If you've learned something in here today that you didn't know before, go tell somebody, don't just keep it to yourself. I'm sure they run out and tell 10 people, I don't know. But I tell them, I said, you know, share this knowledge. And the one other thing that I think is incredibly important is to really share that passion with other people, disavow people of the notion that history is about memorizing dates. That's why I have Google, okay? I think knowing a basic chronology is important, but I want students to see my excitement. So when I teach, I'm always switching things up, right? I'm like, well, we're gonna look at this 5-minute document and I want you to tell me what happened. Or better yet, I want you to make a documentary and then we'll talk about how you do that, what you incorporated, and why. It doesn't have to be a sage on the stage scenario all the time, right? I think the learning process should be interactive, and I think that goes a long way toward getting people engaged and keeping them engaged. And then go to Mosaic Timbers Cultural Center.
Yeah, people can, of course, come here. We're open to the public. I always encourage people to, if you think about a topic or you think about somebody, just ask the question, did a Black person do that? Were they involved in that? So no matter what topic or field that you're interested in, if it's, we just came out with we just got the printing back on a STEM guide that we did for, it's called Have History, Will Travel, about African-Americans in transportation, so on planes, trains, and automobiles. And so what's fun about that kit is that it talks about things like electric cars and how electric cars run, mm-hmm. and how gasoline cars run, and how African-Americans helped to build the wire circuitry that was involved in that process. So when you're driving a car, right, an African-American helped build that. So, you know, begin to think about those things. When you're studying poetry, when you're looking or reading those poets, you know, ask yourself the question, well, is there a Black poet I could investigate, I could learn more about, I could read from? So when you're already going about the things that you normally do, when you're even doing recipes, right? When you're cooking, think about, well, is there a Black chef that I could maybe learn something about the history of food, or I could use their recipe? But really begin to think and explore that, because as people start to do those things, then it'll become part of who they are, right? As Sheree said, right? When you're hearing it on the radio, you're hearing those Black history facts on the radio, you think to yourself, huh, I didn't know that. I'm going to see if there's a book at the library that I can learn more about. That's a really interesting fact. And so it encourages people to do their own exploration. I also think that, you know, as we've talked about, just even the difference between, you know, Stephanie's education and having Black history taught in the classroom on a regular basis, I think that is so crucial to changing people's perceptions, to changing their ideas about history, about who has history, about who owns history, mm-hmm. who shares history. So getting, you know, youth involved at an early age with sharing that history, learning that history, exploring that history, I think, again, is so crucial for us to not still be having conversations like, why isn't Black history taught in schools, right? Or having conversations and bills come up about why we should or shouldn't teach Black history, right? 10 years from now, 5 years from now.
And not only that, I would really like that same energy energy and promotion for the month of February to go all year round. So like every time you look at something, you turn on the television, there is some marketing based on that because February is right around the corner. Same way with most recently with the summer with the uprisings. And I put my air quotes with that. You know, that brought attention, and out of nowhere, it almost kind of came off like a trend. But then, I all of the different corporations and whatnot would change their profile pictures to all black or whatnot. But now it's back to the regular scheduled program. Let's keep that same energy going all the way around.
And absolutely. Stop giving people, right? This let's cancel the idea that we have to turn over our social media to black people for the month of February.
Uh-huh.
Like, I don't want that. I don't want it just for the month of February, right? We want to see it at the table all
black is not a trend.
No, not only that, if they were consistent with it, you wouldn't see a lot of renowned high fashion brands in trouble and making Twitter statements about a certain advertisement with t-shirts and jump and whatever. The thing is, if you had that representation all the way around, there is someone at a table, and I'm sure it's probably a black woman, to say, "Nah, don't do that," before you even put it out there.
No. What you're not gonna do is
that's it. Not today, not tomorrow, and definitely not yesterday. So it's definitely something you have to be consistent with. You have to do it all year round, mm-hmm. and you have to keep that same energy.
Right.
And you have to listen to them, right?
Absolutely.
Stop tokenizing. Stop having your one black person at the table and calling that.
That you don't even listen to. And I'm a mute after that.
Yeah. Well, thank you all so very much for sharing your stories today. I really enjoyed the conversation. I hope you did too. We really, really appreciate your time.
Thank you for inviting us. Thank you. Us behalf. Thank you.
Our guests today were Stephanie Sims from the University of Arkansas at Pine Bluff, Charisse Jones Branch from Arkansas State University, and Christina Schutt from the Mosaic Templars Cultural Center. Thank you once again for taking the time to share your insight with us. That's all for today's episode. And remember, you can listen to past editions of this podcast at argotsoul.com/affirmativeaction. You can also subscribe and rate our show on Apple Podcasts. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next month with a brand new episode. Until then, take care.